You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And over the last few days, there has been a lot of Sturm und Drang. I mean, actually, over the last 3 years, but in particular over the last 3 days, where Betsy McCoy, who came on this program and tried to repeat this mantra, has been running around saying, Obamacare is going to destroy Medicare because he's so eager to give money to those poor, subtext of the message, black people. Right. I mean, this is basically the meme that's going out on Fox and whatnot. Not that Maggie herself said poor black people, but the way that message is spun, they're taking it out of the hands of older white people and giving it to poor people who are in the, you know, you say poor people, even though the majority of poor people in America are white, say poor people and Fox News viewers think black people. It's just, you know, it's a fact of life. And that's why politicians for years and years, particularly white racist politicians, have trashed the poor. It's how and why they get away with it, because it's a subset of racism. So anyhow, there's that. And I didn't know the statistics and facts to rebut that, so I wanted to get that. Plus, there's just a million questions that people have about the Affordable Care Act, you know, a.k.a. Obamacare, and what it is and how it works and all that. And I've been promising you for several days that we will get Wendell Potter back on the program because he knows everything. I mean, the guy was a former senior executive, vice president with one of the largest of the big five health insurance companies, you know, in the world, presumably, and certainly in the United States. And he knows the Affordable Care Act inside out. And, you know, journalist, contributor to the Huffington Post, a participant in the Center for Public Integrity, author of a new book that will be coming out, Obamacare, What's in It for Me, What Everyone Needs to Know About the Affordable Care Act. His website is WendellPotter.com, and it's spelled just like you'd think, two D's, two L's, two T's, just the normal WendellPotter.com. And Wendell, welcome back to the program.
Tom, thanks so much for having me back. How are you doing?
I am great. Your book is not out yet. Is it available in the usual places for pre-order? So if somebody walks into their local bookstore or if they go to one of the online sellers, they can pre-order it?
Well, it's going to be the publication date is December the 6th, and it's going to be initially published as an e-book. I wanted to try to get this out sooner than later, and if you have a real book, it takes longer. So that's the publication date, and I think it'll be available on you know, the regular places where you can buy e-books.
Great, great. Okay, super. I want to get a copy.
Thank you.
You can't imagine. Well, you can't imagine the variety and breadth and sometimes micro minutia of the questions that I get that I can't answer. So I want to read your book. And let me add, Wendell can be here with us until 10 minutes before the hour, until 3:50 Eastern time for the next roughly 40 minutes. And then at 3:50, Elliot Richardson is going to drop by. He's with the Small Business Advocacy Council in Chicago, which is to talk about Obamacare and how they're doing that in Chicago. But that's a whole other thing. But so if you have a question about Obamacare that you would like to ask Wendell Potter, he is here. So, Wendell, let's start out at the beginning with this this story that Betsy McCoy has been telling, which is an echo of the mantra that Mitt Romney was reciting, which is Obamacare takes $700 million, $500 million, pick your, you know, who's saying what when, hundreds of millions of dollars out of Medicare and puts it into Medicaid. What's the real story here?
Yeah, that's it's just a scare tactic coming back, and she is a master manipulator, I'm afraid. So much of what she said in the recent past and distant past has been proven to be so erroneous. In fact, this was, you may remember, during the presidential campaign, Mitt Romney and others were saying that the Obama administration was cutting the Medicare program by billions of dollars. They came up with a number of $716 billion. The reality is, what that is, there are no cuts to benefits whatsoever. The Affordable Care Act strengthens benefits, first of all. It provides coverage for preventive care for the first time for Medicare.
So Obamacare is actually expanding Medicare.
It is, and not only that, it is reducing the donut hole. It will, in fact, soon, in the next few years, close it completely. If you don't know what I'm talking about, the Medicare drug benefit has a gap in it that after the program pays a certain amount of money, then it doesn't pay anything more for quite a long time until you pay full freight for your medications until you reach another point. That's being closed. That's called a donut hole. What this is all about is for the past several years, the Medicare program has been overpaying private insurance companies by billions of dollars to participate in something that was created during the Bush administration called the Medicare Advantage Program.
Now, my understanding is that we actually pay private insurance companies 117%. Correct me if I'm wrong on this. I heard it from a caller.
Yep.
117% of what would normally be paid out in Medicare. We pay that to the insurance companies,
yep.
And then they deliver basically Medicare to people. Is that how it works?
That's exactly how it works. It's quite a sweet deal for private insurance companies. Absolutely an incredibly profitable business for many insurance companies that are in this program. They are getting that extra 17%. And the service that is being provided to beneficiaries is equivalent in most cases to what people in traditional Medicare get. So what the Affordable Care Act does is reduce those bonus payments to private insurance companies so that that program would be more on an even keel with traditional Medicare. So it has nothing whatsoever to do with reducing benefits. It is extending the life of the Medicare program by reducing this unnecessary spending. The Government Accountability Office estimated that just within between 2010 and 2012, the Medicare program overpaid private insurance companies close to $5 billion.
Wow. So, and which is why UnitedHealthcare, which is I think probably the largest provider of these things, they do it through AARP. Why they were able to compensate Stephen Hemsley, their CEO, with over $1 billion during the time that he's been the CEO.
Yeah, and keep in mind, he has been at times the highest paid chief executive officer in the country.
Wow. Well, $1 billion is a hell of a lot of money.
So,
I get people calling into the program who say, I just got notified that my Medicare is going to be cut next year. And I go, really, your Medicare? Yes, I got the email from, and they fill in the blank of the name of the company. Last week it was somebody who said Kaiser. Kaiser sent me this notification that that my Medicare is being cut. And my response, uneducated, correct me if I'm wrong, was you're not taking Medicare. You're taking Medicare Advantage. Maybe you should consider dumping Medicare Advantage, dumping Kaiser, and just signing up for Medicare. Is that a rational response to that? We have a minute before the break here.
You're absolutely right. It is exactly what's going on. People are signing up for these plans thinking they're in traditional Medicare. What they're doing is moving out of traditional Medicare into the arms of a private insurance company that can, at its whim, decide to change benefits. That's exactly what's going on.
And at their whim, they are changing benefits, in part because the gravy train is coming to an end.
Yep.
So can people at any time who are on Medicare Advantage, whether it's through AARP and UnitedHealthcare, or whether it's with Kaiser or whatever, can they simply say, I think I'm just going to go back to Medicare?
You can do that. In fact, my mother was in one of these kinds of plans, a Medicare Advantage plan, until about a couple of years ago, and we moved her back into traditional Medicare. There may be windows of opportunity for people to do that, but you can, and I
okay.
would strongly.
And in traditional Medicare, there is a gap. There is a 20%. You can buy Medigap coverage, though, can't you?
Exactly. Medicare supplement plans are different from Medicare Advantage plans.
Medicare supplement plans are different from Medicare Advantage plans. So it's all about the magic words. And
exactly.
And the weasels are using, they're saying Medicare and they're forgetting to include the word Advantage.
That's exactly right.
Amazing. Wendell Potter with us. He'll be taking your calls after the break. It's 15 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Everything you ever wanted to know about Obamacare.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And maybe even a few things you didn't know that you needed to know about Obamacare. We'll be talking about all that right after this. And welcome back, Wendell. You're still with us?
I sure am.
Okay. Jeff in Langston, Pennsylvania is watching us on Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. Jeff, you have a question for Wendell?
Yes. It's Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Oh, Lancaster. My apologies.
That's okay. That's quite all right. Wendell, I was an insurance agent for 19 years, and I remember I live in Pennsylvania when these Advantage plans first came into the state of Pennsylvania. Now I'm going back into the 90s. You could get into some of them with zero premiums, and they at first they tried dental, eye, just like the greatest thing in the world. But what happened as time went on, claims drove the cost up, so they had to pull out of the state. And the other thing, and tell me if I'm wrong, when you get on one of these Advantage plans, the money that they take from your Social Security, right,
yep,
for Medicare,
right,
you're basically given that private insurance company permission to manage what would be your Medicare in the private sector.
Yep. You are so right. I'm really glad you brought that up. That's exactly what's happened. It's why we shifted my mother back into traditional Medicare. What people don't realize, and this became very apparent to my mother, she had to go into a nursing home, and for a while after she broke her hip, she was needing significant care. She was not going to get that. A utilization review nurse that the insurance company said, nope, it's not medically necessary. So people need to know that. You're putting your hands, your health in the hands of a person you will have never have a chance to meet, who will make a judgment as to whether or not the treatment your doctor recommends is medically necessary.
So if you join Medicare Advantage, you get a death panel.
You get a death panel. You're exactly right. You put yourself at risk of being told you cannot get care. Exactly. And Betsy McGaughy was one of those who came up with the terms death panel. This is exactly where they are. People are afraid of death panels in Obamacare. They're not there. They are inside the major for-profit insurance companies.
Yeah, pretty remarkable. Okay, Joyce, watching Free Speech TV in Clearfield, Pennsylvania. A lot of Pennsylvania viewers today. Joyce, you're on the air with Wendell Potter.
Thank you so much. Mr. Potter, I'd like to ask you about on TV, every night when I watch TV, you see all these commercials for free things, like free wheelchairs, and maybe they're free for you, and maybe just a little bit of cost, and meters like for diabetics, and braces like for your older and your knees, and all these things. Does Medicare pay for that and Medicaid?
Well, it depends. You know, some things are paid for by Medicare, medical devices that are necessary. Some things that you see advertised are not covered by Medicare. But if it's something that you need, that your doctor says you need, and it's a covered benefit, then you can get it, whether or not it's advertised on TV or not.
Are some of those things available through Medicare, but not through Medicare Advantage, like your mother's hip, the treatment or the nursing home for her?
Well, what I was talking about there is that they were not going to be paying for skilled nursing care after a certain period of time. They have very strict limits on that. Mother needed skilled nursing care,
right,
but they were cutting that off. And they were able to do that because, as the previous caller suggested, they call the shots on that, not your doctors and not
yeah.
the people at the nursing home.
They're in it to make a buck. I mean, you know, this is the bottom line. Wendell Potter, we'll be right back with Wendell Potter. Hang on just a second. Minutes past the hour, Wendell Potter, former senior executive. You were vice president with Aetna, weren't you, Wendell?
With Cigna.
Cigna.
Humana before that.
Cigna, thank you very much. Former big shot in the health insurance industry, and now the author, actually his most recent book is Dudley Spin, and in December he's got a new book coming out titled Obamacare. It'll be an e-book, and you can look for it in the regular place. And just check his website regularly, WendellPotter.com. So, Wendell, let's pick up some phone calls here. Judy in Northampton, Mass., listening to WHMP. Hey, Judy, you're on the air with Wendell.
Hi. I turned it on just at the right time, your show. Couple things. I just retired. I'm 72, and I signed up for Medicare. Actually, that's a couple of years ago before I retired. And I went to, I think it's called Shine, I'm not sure, it's some kind of state, I live in Massachusetts, program that you can go to, it's at the senior center here. And she put all my medications in and my conditions, and she figured out that I would be better off on plain Medicare, which I was glad because I was just going to sign up for one of those people that send messages, you know, send me letters all the time, United Healthcare, which is through AARP and it's Tufts and I don't know what other. I was just going to sign up for one of those. I figured it would be better. Why not? Why would it? Of course it would be better, but it wasn't better. And now I'm hearing you say supplement, Medicare supplement and Medicare Advantage are different, and I never even heard of them being different. I just thought they were both, you know, those other companies that make a ton of money off of supplying Medicare to people.
So Wendell, can you explain what a Medicare supplement is? We know that Medicare Advantage is basically the health insurance company gets 117% from the government and then basically just gives you Medicare.
Right.
But what's a Medicare supplement and why is it necessary? Thank you, Judy.
Yeah, it's, as you noted earlier, in the Medicare program, the traditional Medicare program, if you go to the hospital, you have a co-insurance obligation. The government will pay 80% of your cost, but that leaves you facing 20% of medical costs. It can be pretty significant. So a lot of people, maybe most people who have Medicare, buy private Medicare supplement plans. And usually it's fairly modest monthly premium. It depends, I guess, on your age and where you live and things like that. But it covers that out-of-pocket obligation. It helps you meet your out-of-pocket obligations if you get seriously ill. It's worth considering because it can protect you from high out-of-pocket expenses.
Right.
It is different from Medicare Advantage. Medicare Advantage is a replacement, a private replacement for the Medicare program.
Okay. So, and these programs are called Medigap, aren't they often?
Yes, that's exactly right. They're Medigap programs.
Okay. And so what they do is they supplement Medicare instead of replacing it. So,
that's right.
And the Medicare Advantage programs, even the ones that seem really cool right now, they're actually, Obamacare is dialing back on the money that's going to these private health insurance companies that are offering these plans. And so those plans are going to get less attractive over time, which means that anybody who, like, you know, I'm not old enough to qualify for Medicare, but I will be in 4 years, 3 years,
that's
I guess.
Right.
And
being,
so I should be, you know, just planning on signing up for Medicare. What the heck? That's all.
Yeah.
I don't need to do all that research.
That's exactly right. What the Obama administration is doing through Obamacare is making these companies spend more of the money that we pay if we're enrolled in a Medicare Advantage plan on our care rather than going to Stephen Hemley's
pocketbook.
Retirement fund.
Right, okay, to buy another mansion.
Right.
Got it. Wendell Potter's with us. Mike in San Jose, California. You have a question?
Yes, I do. Suppose you have a married couple filing jointly, and the older spouse is over 65 and on Medicare, and the younger spouse is under 65 and looking for looking on the exchange. In figuring the tax credit available to the younger spouse, is that based on their joint income? Is it based on the individual income of the younger spouse, or what is it based on? And just as a comment, I am on Medicare Advantage with Kaiser, and at this point, at least, I'm pretty happy with it.
Yeah, and a lot of people are happy with their Medicare Advantage plans. In fact, my mother was pretty happy with it as well, too, for many years. But like I'm saying,
until she needed skilled nursing, and
exactly.
They said no.
And that's what, to go off on a tangent here just a little bit, there's a lot of talk about junk insurance plans in today's news, and a lot of talk about people getting notices that their plans are not going to be available next year, the private plans, and that is because a lot of those plans are junk plans. People enroll in plans that are very inadequate, don't cover their needs if they get really sick or injured. And most people, though, go day by day and don't realize how inadequately insured they are. It's only, you know, the few unfortunate folks who actually do get sick and need to use their insurance to find out that it's not going to be there for them.
Yeah, I describe those plans as the insurance equivalent of subprime mortgages.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And the same can be said for these Medicare Advantage plans.
So Wendell, we just have a minute before the break. To the caller's question, if, for example, I sign up for Medicare, I get a paycheck. My wife, even though she works 12 hours a day, does not get a paycheck. She's also 2 years younger than me. So if I signed up for Medicare and she wants to shop on the exchange, is her income my income because we file together, or is her income zero, which is actually what Louise gets?
I think it's her income because these are individual policies.
Mm-hmm. So it would be to the individual.
Yes.
Okay. And you have a fairly high level of certainty of that, or is that?
I can double check that.
Okay.
But I think that's probably the case. It's an individual policy, but we can double check that.
Okay. We have 30 seconds if you want to finish the story I interrupted you with.
Well, just that people need to be very mindful, whether they're signing up for a Medicare Advantage plan or a commercial plan, to be sure that you're aware of what your out-of-pocket obligations will be. And also know that in any private insurance plan, you are more than likely going to be subjected to decisions made by some bureaucrat somewhere who can override the decisions that your doctor makes.
Right, and decide to cut you off if it starts getting expensive. Wendell Potter, we'll be back in 5 minutes right after the news with more of your questions for Wendell.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Wendell's last book, Deadly Spin, is website WendellPotter.com. Just like you'd expect. Check it out. We'll be right back. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. I should have mentioned at the top of the hour, this week and this week only, we're doing our annual fundraising drive for our program's official charity, the New England Salem Children's Village and the Hunter School, the website hunterschool.org or salemchildrensvillage.org. And this is a great and important charity that is transforming, literally changing the lives of children and setting, it, more importantly, I think, in many ways, setting an example for other programs, both public and private, working with children on the autistic spectrum in particular. And children who have problems with rage and violence and things, and they really need your help. The number is 800-897-8358, 1-800-897-8358. We're trying to raise at least $10,000 this week to put a new roof on one of the houses and replace one of the kitchens, put generators in the houses, and pave the driveway. And we'd like to raise more than that. So if you can please make a contribution, it would be much appreciated. 800-897-8358. Or go to hunterschool.org or salemchildrensvillage.org, and you will see the programs, and there's a donate button there. So back to Wendell Potter. Wendell, you're still with us?
I sure am.
Great. Thank you so much. Let's pick up some calls here. David, and yeah. By the way, the lines are slammed. If you want to give short answers, feel
you're
free.
You're picking me up, Nick.
David in Eureka, California. You're on the air with Wendell Potter.
Hi, Wendell and Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to talk about why, or I guess I'm asking the question, why people can't have my insurance. Now, I've been retired 3 years now. I pay $550 a year. My co-pays are $12 per visit, you know, unlimited visits. I've never seen caps on my insurance. My prescription drugs are either $6, $9, $12, or $17 now for albuterol inhalers. I'm not sure why. I have a son that, you know, right after I retired, we had to get brain surgery for him. The total bill was $350,000. You know, I'm a retiree. How am I going to pay all that? So my total out of pocket expense for that surgery was $120, and they actually gave me travel vouchers to get from Eureka to San Francisco to get it done. So now, of course, the crux of all this is I'm retired military, but I'm in TRICARE for Life, the single-payer insurance program that provides me with the medical care for my family, you know, for all of us. I've had TRICARE my entire life, pretty much, since 20 years old when I joined the Navy. And it's taken care of me and my family. I've never worried about medical bills. All those costs have been picked up, and you know, I just don't understand why we can't have that. First, you know, the Affordable Care Act is a great start, yes, but we need, you know, the program I'm in for everybody. And, you know, honestly, we need it to be free for everyone.
Yeah, boy, do we ever need a program like yours. And yes, the TRICARE program is a good program.
Thank you, David.
And also, the Veterans Administration runs a pretty good program, too. These are government-run programs. What we've been told to fear most is a government-run program, which is what Medicare is. A TRICARE program is run by the government, which contracts with private insurance companies to administer the benefits. But that's what we need to move toward and away from the a system that is controlled by for-profit health insurance companies that get to call the shots, not the government.
That's amazing. His premium is $500 a year. I mean, that's $50 a month, less than 50. It's incredible. Stanley in West Point, Mississippi. You're on the air with I keep wanting to say Senator Sanders. I'm so used to doing this with Bernie. You're on the air with Senator Potter, with Wendell Potter.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I have two questions, Mr. Potter. In a state such as Mississippi, which is overweight and of a least healthy population in the U.S., what mandatory stipulations are insurance companies under to participate in these less advantaged and less attractive markets? In lieu of adequate competition, would a government option help ensure fairer rates? And my second question, as I understand it, if a certain percentage of the premiums aren't used for health care, the insurers will be required to rebate funds to the consumer. If a consumer does it through his company, do the rebates go to these large companies, and are there laws written ensuring that these refunds will go to the worker who paid them in, or is the company at their discretion to keep them?
Thank you, Stanley.
Yeah, I'll answer the second one first. Yes, if an insurance company doesn't spend at least 80% of what they take in premiums on care, they have to issue rebate checks. It's 85% for large groups, large employers. Now, the rebates go to policyholders. That can be individuals if the individuals buy the policies on their own. If you get it through a group, through an employer, then your employer is actually the policyholder, and that goes to the employer, and it's the employer's prerogative as to whether or not to share that rebate money with you. That's just the way it is. Now, with to your first question, we need a public option. We were cheated out of that. The problem is, without that, in some markets, some states, there are not a lot of insurance companies that are going to be competing. And I think Mississippi is one of them, and there's some other small states where there are not a lot of insurance companies competing. So we not only will you not have a lot of competition among private insurers, we will not anywhere have a public option, which would have served, as the president once said, to keep insurance companies more honest and to help bring premiums down.
Instead of trashing Obamacare, the Republicans wanted to actually fix it, the simple way would be to put a public option in.
That's right, exactly.
Yeah, okay. Dave, in Armstrong Creek, Wisconsin, you're on the air with Wendell Potter.
Hi, Mr. Potter, and thanks a lot for all the information today. I'd like to ask you, what, in your opinion, do you think the main drivers have been in like the last 20, 25 years of just the exponential rise of healthcare costs? I mean, you know, it just seems like such a mystery. There's so many factors that could be involved. Could you give me your ideas on that?
Yeah, and there has been some moderating influence on medical inflation, but there are a lot of factors. One, I'll start with my former industry. Insurance companies make sure that they have a certain profit margin they want to protect, and they price their policies based on what they think medical inflation will be. And they have demonstrated that they're not able to control medical inflation as much as they said they could years ago when they helped defeat the Clinton plan. We have a health delivery system that is out of control. You have duplication of medical services among hospitals, for example. Hospitals just blocks from each other have a duplication of equipment, very, very expensive equipment that's not necessary. So we spend so much on technology and bells and whistles that it's just a duplication of services, but we all have to pay for it. That's one of the reasons. Plus, we pay across the board more for medications, more for doctor visits and doctor care and physician and hospital care than any other country in the world. And that is because we've had this so-called free market system without appropriate regulations on either insurance or the healthcare delivery system.
Mark in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening on KABQ. You're on the air with Wendell Potter.
Yes, thank you both for what you do in teaching us how to develop a real safety net for the public. I had a question about the states that have opted out of participating in Obamacare, and how has that affected premiums and how the program was originally envisioned?
Well, Obamacare will affect premiums across the country in I think, positive ways, because even without the public option, most states, there will be more competition. People will, at long last, be able to shop for coverage in a rational way, and they'll be able to compare one policy with another. We've never been able to do that before. We'll be able to get policy information in plain language. We haven't been able to get that before, and in the standard format that permits us to make these comparisons. Just that transparency alone, and the fact that we'll be able to shop in ways that we've never been able to do before, will bring the cost of premiums down, or at least moderate the cost of premiums.
So if you live in a state where they didn't create an exchange, are you going to pay more?
Well, every state will have an exchange. It doesn't matter whether the states are operating them or the federal government is. And one of the problems is that 36 states chose not to operate their own exchanges,
right,
meaning the federal government has to do
so
that.
So you're not going to pay more. You're just going to have to deal with the clunky federal government website.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right for the time being.
All right. We have 1 minute left. Judy, got a quick question for Wendell? Judy in Seattle?
Are you talking to me?
Yes.
Oh, in thank you. In Washington State, we have Group Health, which is a nonprofit and like a co-op.
Yep.
And I'm on Medicare, and I'm thinking of joining the Group Health Advantage care program. And I'm wondering, how will Obamacare affect such a nonprofit Advantage program?
Not so much. And it is one of the better private, it's an integrated healthcare delivery system, one of the best in the country. So if I were to consider a Medicare Advantage plan, I would want to consider one operated by that organization or something like it.
Yeah, but they're not available in most parts of the country.
Exactly right, just a very few.
Yeah, in most parts of the country, it's just a for-profit program that you have. Wendell Potter, he's the author of Deadly Spin, and he's got a new book coming out called Obamacare, What's in It for Me, What Everyone Needs to Know About the Affordable Care Act, which will be available as an e-book in early December, and WendellPotter.com, the website. Thank you, Wendell.
Thank you, Tom.
Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And Wendell has left the building. So, but we're going to be back with Elliot Richardson, an interesting Obamacare story. Welcome back. And Mana in Cassville, Missouri?
Yes.
Hi, Wendell's no longer here, but I know some of the answers. Maybe I can help.
Okay, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I was wondering about this straight Medicare.
Right.
I have the Advantage plan now, but they're dropping this area.
Mm-hmm. We talked about this early on in the hour, so I'm pretty sure that my facts are right on this.
I know, but it wasn't clear to me.
Right.
The government still takes out so much of your Social Security.
That's
for
right.
Insurance.
That's right.
So I would still pay that.
That's correct. Medicare Advantage and regular Medicare, right now the way it works is the government is giving the private health insurance company 117%. So they take, you know, they take the money out of your Social Security. That's the 100%. And then the government gives them 17% on top of that to offer you a spiffier plan. And so some of the Medicare Advantage programs are better than just straight Medicare. That is going away over the next 5 years or so as Obamacare starts cutting that subsidy to these Advantage programs. So my understanding of what Wendell said and my understanding of what I had learned before that was if you have a Medicare Advantage program, keep comparing it to regular Medicare, because the Medicare Advantage programs as time goes on, year after year after year, are going to start to get to be less and less of a good deal. And Wendell was telling the story about how his mother, she was on a Medicare Advantage program. She needed nursing care after she broke her hip. The death panel at the health insurance company said, no, we won't provide that. So he moved her on to regular Medicare, which did provide it. So you might want to just talk with somebody at check out the website, medicare.gov, or talk to somebody at Medicare. They have a telephone line.
Would I have to pay regular doctor's fees for visits?
I don't know at that level of detail. What I do know is that you can buy relatively inexpensively a supplemental policy that's not Medicare Advantage, that doesn't replace Medicare like Medicare Advantage does, but that fills in all the holes in Medicare, that fills in the donut hole for the health insurance, that fills in the physician copays, that fills in the 80%, you know, the 20% that you have to pay for a lot of expenses. You can buy those policies in the marketplace, and those are called Medigap policies, and they're different from Medicare Advantage.
Yes. But I would have to start paying so much a month for that. Right now, I don't pay a monthly fee.
That's correct. That's correct, because the government is subsidizing the Medicare Advantage company, and they're making a profit off it. And actually, you know, you're paying for that. You just don't realize it if you're paying any income tax at all, because, you know, we the taxpayers are paying for that subsidy. So perhaps you're not paying income taxes, and a lot of people probably aren't. So,
no.
But it's not. My understanding is it's not a great deal of money. So
I just don't understand how I would benefit from going on straight Medicare.
You may, right now you may not, because the Medicare Advantage program, because it's subsidized by the government, may be offering you a better plan than straight Medicare. But over the next few years, that's going to change. So just check. I would, you know, check with Medicare, Medicare.org, or just call them and say, here's my Medicare Advantage plan. Tell me, you know, should I be with you guys or should I not? Which way should I go? And I'm confident that they'll tell you. So, Nana, thank you for the call. We'll be right back. It's 10 minutes before you. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And just a reminder, we're doing this week. It's Thursday, so it's just today and tomorrow is going to be the end of it. We're raising money for the Hunter School, an extraordinarily wonderful charity. I have a certain amount of bias. Louise and I started it back in 1978, and have been affiliated with it all these years. But it's that said, I encourage you to check out their website at hunterschool.org and salemchildrensvillage.org, or even go visit them. They welcome visitors. And if you can get up into central northern New Hampshire, out in the woods there in Rumney, near Plymouth, New Hampshire. And this is just a wonderful program. Please call 800-897-8358 and make a contribution. We're trying to put a new roof on one of the houses that actually has a leaky roof. Not a good thing, and winter is coming. And get generators for all the houses, because as the storms are getting more and more frequent, we're losing electricity more and more frequently, and electricity is pretty essential. And a new kitchen. And a new kitchen floor in Mountain House, and some painting the outside of the school building. So please, 800-897-8358. Now, all that said, Elliot Richardson is with us. He's the CEO of the Small Business Advocacy Council in Chicago, Illinois, a group that works with small businesses and advocates on their behalf. SBACIL.org is the website. And Elliot, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Tom, thanks for having me again. I really appreciate it.
Did I accurately characterize the Small Business Advocacy Council, or do you want to expand on that a little bit first?
You know, you were pretty much spot on. Basically, we're an organization laser-focused on running the ball down the center of the field for small business owners and advocating for the entire small business community. So we have about 800 businesses in our organization, but we've built a coalition of 20 to 30,000 businesses that fight for an array of issues from the perspective of the real small business owner. So that, in a nutshell, is what we do.
Okay. And do you have members outside of Illinois?
You know, right now we're just in Illinois. So
okay.
We're in the Chicagoland area and the Chicago
okay.
area.
So for anybody else, you know, if there's not something like your group in if there's not something like the Small Business Advisory Council, the SBAC, in your town, you might want to think of starting one.
And we're happy to help, absolutely. There
cool.
is such power through critical mass. It's really amazing.
Now, you all have been looking at Obamacare and and working on a self-insured health insurance cooperative in Illinois. Do I have that right?
Absolutely. Yeah, what we've been doing is looking at Obamacare, but really in a very narrow focus. So essentially about 3 years ago, what we wanted to do was bring a health insurance cooperative to Illinois, and that's essentially an insurance company owned by the members of the cooperative, small business owners and entrepreneurs in our case, and operated by our advocates. So we worked very hard with a large coalition of businesses to pass a bill to ensure that health insurance co-ops were legal in Illinois, and we're lucky enough to have a health insurance co-op that has been funded, that's being built, and now offering health insurance called Land of Lincoln. And we're just very, very excited about this co-op. It's run by folks in the medical profession, in the medical care world, and by financial experts, and it's a nonprofit, no shareholders. You know, the entire focus of this co-op is to bring down the cost of health insurance, stabilize the cost of health insurance, and provide quality care to its members.
Great. So how does this work, and what can people in other states do if they wanted to emulate what you're doing there?
Well, 26 states were funded. So co-ops in 26 states were funded. I'm not exactly sure what all those states are. In other states, unfortunately, it's going to be very difficult to get something like this started. You know, what I would say is find out if you've got a cooperative in your state. Again, it's really a game changer for small business owners and for people in the co-op, because for years we've seen our rates go up. I mean, this was long before Obamacare. This was long before President Obama was even a state senator. You know, I ran my own business, and every year I got 15 to 20% raises in my insurance premiums. And there was nothing we can do about it. Small business owners just didn't have a voice in what was going on in health insurance. And here comes a cooperative where not only do you have a voice, you're part of the decision-making process. And that's what's so beautiful about it.
So people in the Chicago area or in Illinois can who run small businesses can participate through sbacil.org, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, if you're in other states, find out whether or not you've got a co-op. And if you don't, we'd be happy to talk to you, to do anything that we can to point you in the right direction to get it going. You know, when you're an owner, when you have skin in the game and you can impact decision-making process of the folks who are providing you with insurance, well, then people are going to do what's in your best interest. And that's what's so excited about it.
Does joining a co-op in one of the 26 states where it's funded and possible, and it's a shame it's not all 50.
I agree with that.
That's a whole other topic, I suppose, for another day. But does joining a co-op, if I, you know, I mean, I own a small business, right? It's this radio show.
Yep.
And or Louise and I own it, I should say. But to honor my partner. If we did that, if we were in a state that offered that, and I'm frankly not sure if Washington, D.C. does or doesn't, but if we did that, would we then not be required, you know, would we be exempt from Obamacare requirements to, you know, buy something on the exchange, whether it's individual or group?
It's a great question, Tom. In Illinois and in all these other states, the co-op products are actually on the exchange.
Oh ho!
It's fantastic.
So you go into the Illinois. If I, as a small business owner in Illinois, go into the Illinois Health Insurance Exchange, I'm going to see your product.
Absolutely, bam! It's going to be right there. It is now an alternative with the for-profit insurance companies that are going to be out there. So it's actually a fifth insurance company in Illinois.
Are you finding that the presence of a not-for-profit in among these for-profit insurance companies is causing them to drop their prices?
Absolutely. What we're seeing, I mean, all the pricing isn't out yet. All the pricing isn't set. But what we're seeing is that there is competition.
Yeah.
And that certainly the co-op is doing everything in that it can to bring down.
Yeah. Well, that's what it does to the marketplace. We need more people like you, Elliot Richardson. SBACIL.org. Thanks for being with us.
Okay. Thank you so much, Tom.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at solarworld.com, carbonite.com, automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at carbonite.com, angieslist.com, detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at angieslist.com, stamps.com, postage online from your computer. More information at stamps.com, and our website, tomhartmann.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at tomhartmann.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. Just a reminder, we're doing our fund drive, our annual one-week fundraising drive. Today is Thursday. It's the next to the last day. You're next to the last chance to go to hunterschool.org and or salemchildrensvillage.org. Read about the program. Go up and visit them. See what they're doing. They're doing some extraordinary work with children who just can't make it in public schools. And in many cases, just can't even make it at home. And they need your help. It's a 501c3 charity. This is the end of the year. This is a tax-deductible donation. Their toll-free number is 800-897-8358 to make a donation, 800-897-8358. And if you want to just call them up and talk with them, their phone number is on their website for the, you know, just call and talk to Lori or Jim or somebody who works there. And, in fact, we're going to have a guest on later on in the program from the Hunter School to tell you, one of the house parents there to tell you about it. Kevin Camps is with us right now. Those of you who hear our newscasts know that in our newscast today, we every day now we're reporting the radcast.org statistics. They say that the alert level is 100 counts per minute, and Frederick, Wisconsin today is averaging 59 counts per minute, but it's spiking at 74. Three different cities in Arizona, Chino Valley, Prescott, and Tucson, they're all averaging around 60 counts per minute or above. The East Coast today has seen some high levels, 63 counts per minute in Charleston, North Carolina, 71 in Salisbury, Mass. And Radcast has issued a warning about hot rain in Salisbury, Mass. If you're in Salisbury, Mass, and it's raining, get out of the rain. It's spiking at over 120. Radcast reminds us that anything over 100 counts per minute is what they consider an alert. Kevin Camps with BeyondNuclear.org is on the line with us. He's the radioactive waste watchdog with Beyond Nuclear. And, Kevin, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. What do those Radcast numbers tell you, Kevin?
You know, I need to start carrying my Radler handheld monitor again, it sounds like. You know, I'm used to levels around 10 to 20 counts per minute. I'm from West Michigan, and I used to carry a Radler regularly, and that's what I would get all the time. And, you know, when it spikes, you know there's perhaps something going on. So I would set my alert level at 30, and once in a while, it'll just jump up that high. Who knows what that was? Could be cosmic radiation. But there have been times when I've gotten very high readings, and it was because there was something going on, and I was then able to figure out what it was.
Yeah. Well, speaking of something going on, any of us who live anywhere near the jet stream are according to Helen Caldicott, in the position to pick up whatever goes on at Fukushima. What's going on at Fukushima?
Well, you've still got the regular daily radioactive releases into the ocean that are traveling with the groundwater, some 72,000 gallons per day of radioactive groundwater flown into the ocean. But then you've got something very significant about to start in a couple weeks. They just gave permission at the Nuclear Regulation Authority of Japan to Tokyo Electric to start removing the high-level radioactive waste from the Unit 4 pool in that badly damaged building. In a couple weeks from now, they're going to start using a crane to pull those irradiated fuel assemblies out of that damaged pool.
Now, I read that the way that they make fuel rods is sort of like, you know, packing a cigarette. You've got this outside tube, and then inside, instead of tobacco, or maybe a better analogy would be if you were to cut the ends off a fluorescent light bulb, you know, fluorescent tube, those long fluorescent tubes, and fill it full of batteries. And so you'd have one giant long battery, right? That there are these cells, these pieces of radioactive material, super enriched uranium and whatnot, that are in these tubes. And the tubes are made out of zirconium, and that zirconium, when it's exposed to the air, catches on fire if it's at all warm. Is that true? And if that's the case, how are they going to pull these things out of a water pool without bursting into flames and causing a disaster?
Well, your cigarette analogy is apt. Arnie Gunderson at Fairwinds Associates in Vermont has compared the situation in the Unit 4 pool to a pack of cigarettes that has been crushed, you know, and usually it's easy to get a cigarette out of a pack, but when they're crushed, it's hard to get them out. And he points out that these fuel rods have experienced the earthquake for one thing. They've experienced that big explosion that destroyed the reactor building for another thing. And he warns that they are likely bent. They are likely badly corroded because salt water was used at one point to cool them, and they may be damaged. And pulling them out may be the final straw that causes their disintegration into, pellets. The pellets of uranium could just fall to the bottom of the pool. You don't want that, because enough of those pellets in one place, you've got a critical mass, you could have a nuclear reaction. The dilemma is they have to get the waste out of the pool, because another big earthquake could collapse that building, drain the cooling water away, and now you've got a radioactive inferno that will dwarf what we've seen so far in the last 2 years and 8 months.
Would it be a scenario like Chernobyl or like Nagasaki?
Well, Chernobyl would be a more appropriate comparison because we're talking commercial nuclear power plant, nuclear fuel, but it would be unprecedented. Yeah, there were 200 tons of nuclear fuel at Chernobyl that first caused an explosion and then burned out of control for 10 days. So that's getting closer to what we're looking at. But what we're looking at Fukushima Daiichi Unit 4 is more like 150 tons, okay, less than Chernobyl, but no radiological containment whatsoever. And once that pool water's gone, you've got deadly doses of radioactivity. Human beings cannot approach. Even people in helicopters would be exposed to dangerous levels. And it'd be impossible to put that fire out at that point. It would be just unimaginable radioactivity releases directly into the environment.
Would it be an exaggeration to say that TEPCO is about to begin the most dangerous experiment in the history of the human race?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of competition, right? I mean, there's god-awful wars in Africa going on. There's all kinds of crises going on in the world. But certainly, in terms of the radioactivity that's there, the potential for fire, it's a global risk that's about to take place. And this for-profit, incompetent, dishonest company called Tokyo Electric Power Company, by some absurd reason, is in charge of this process. You know, the Japanese government should be in there. The United States government should be in there. The United Nations should be in there. The best and brightest minds in science, technology, and engineering should be involved in this decision-making, and they're just not.
My original question to you about the zirconium tubes, I don't think you quite answered, not that I think you're being evasive. I want to be clear on the answer to this. If these tubes are combustible and they're going to pull them out of a water pool into the air, how do they do that without them catching on fire, even if they're not crushed?
Well, the way it would work is they would load a transfer cask down into the pool. That's the radiation shielding. They would put the fuel into that transfer cask, pull the cask out of the pool. And that's the radiation shielding so that the nearby workers don't get deadly doses of gamma radiation. They would lower that cask to the ground level and take the fuel then out of the transfer cask and put it into a more permanent, I guess you could say, ground level dry cask for storage.
So they're going to pull the individual pellets out of the tubes and leave the tubes in place?
No. The tubes are bundled into assemblies, and those would stay inside these dry casks. And they have a ground level pool at Fukushima Daiichi.
Right.
That can be a temporary holding place until they can get it into these more permanent dry casks for storage.
So these rods can be exposed to the air for a period of time without a danger of combustion?
Yeah, the transfer casks and the storage casks do have cooling mechanisms built in, and it's not water-based. It's more convection currents of air that carry away the heat.
I see. So it's just a matter of keeping them below the temperature at which zirconium bursts into flames.
Yeah, the ignition temperature of zirconium is something like 2,000 degrees and maybe a little bit lower than that. And
right.
Once it hits that, it will spontaneously combust. And it's an exothermic, self-perpetuating reaction.
Wow, like magnesium.
Yes.
Amazing. Kevin Camps, the Radioactive Waste Watchdog at Beyond Nuclear, beyondnuclear.org. Check out the website. Kevin, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
I think thanks for being with us. I mean, this is pretty scary news. Keep us up to date, would you?
Scarier than Halloween. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, exactly. Today's Halloween, great, and Mercury's retrograde, and they just decided to do this. Kevin, thank you very much. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Once again, a reminder, hunterschool.org. On a more positive note, help change the world for the better. Hunterschool.org. 15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you and Bob watching Free Speech TV in Caspian, Michigan. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, Tom, afternoon. I was just wondering if you ever gave much thought to the health care issue that's going on out there about the cost of all of the violence that's going on throughout this whole country as far as gun wounds, stabbings, broken bones, and they all go to the emergency ward and the hospital at all these emergency wards. They got to bill somebody because these people that was injured or that caused the injuries, they have no health. They're all mainly street people working the streets. And it is causing a big anchor to the healthcare system. And I don't know if they've ever, nothing has ever been mentioned about fixing that problem, if there's even a fix to that.
Yeah.
But
Well, actually, there is, Bob.
Financial issue.
The Centers for Disease Control either used to or were mandated to keep track of gunshot victims as a public health issue. And state agencies were supposed to keep track of this. The federal government was supposed to keep track of this. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms were supposed to keep track of the toll, basically, on America of our heavily weaponized society. And I'm sorry, I don't know the year that this happened, but the NRA, but I believe that it was back in the day, like during the Reagan administration, the NRA lobbied very, very aggressively to make it illegal, literally illegal, not for the government to stop doing this, but to make it illegal for the government to compile statistics on the public health costs of our super militarized or super armed society. And so there are no accurate statistics available. So there are groups that are now starting. There's a Twitter group on this, and I don't want to say the name out loud because I don't remember it exactly, and I might get it wrong. I will find out sometime during the program today. And there's also, in addition to that Twitter group, over at the Daily Kos, they've been doing a great job with what they call gun fail, I believe it's called. And so if you go over to Daily Kos, once a week they report how many children, you know, and they're crowdsourcing this information because the government, because of the NRA buying these largely Republican, but there's a few Democrats too, buying these, congressmen and senators, has passed a law saying that the federal government is not allowed to tell us, Bob.
Huh.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing, isn't it?
It's not just the gunshots, though, too. I mean, it's like the alcohol is a main cause of a lot of the health problems that's causing it. And I'm just kind of curious if...
Well, they track alcoholism.
Listen to the people that are out on the streets as far as are they going to end up paying for so much per year for health care or because they have no money at all.
Right. No, we're gonna provide everybody with health care, and the people who are living on the streets, the people who are living what you might call bad lifestyles, you know, the Skid Row bums who are drinking themselves to death. The good news is twofold. One, we are helping the least among us, these folks. I realize Republicans don't think it's moral to help them, that they should just be allowed to die in the gutter. But two, they're really such a small percentage of our population that it's not going to cost the rest of us any more than a couple of pennies a year to do so. And I think that, you know, I'm more than glad to pay for it. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And we are raising funds this week for the Hunter School in the Salem Children's Village up in Rumney, New Hampshire. You can check out their website at hunterschool.org or salemchildrensvillage.org. The toll-free number, if you'd like to make a donation, is 800-897-8358. 897-8358. And Ryan Barber is with us. He's a house parent at the Hunter School. Hey, Ryan.
Hello. Can you hear me?
I hear you just fine, and okay. I see you, too, on Skype. Great to have you with us. So tell us, what is it like? What's an average day like at the Hunter School? What are you all up to?
Well, you can really never expect anything one way or the other because things can go pretty much any way with these kind of children. But an average day for a house parent, now most of us stay up there for a week at a time, so we kind of have two lives, so to speak. But an average day would be consisting of in the morning, 7 o'clock, six to seven, we'll start waking the kids up and, checking in on them. Usually have to go to the bathroom, a couple of them. And then we'll make breakfast and we'll have a kind of a family breakfast. And then we get them ready for school, which is right on campus. And, we actually have a nice little pathway that we built. We walk the kids to the school along the pathway. Before that, we actually have them walk through a labyrinth. We built a mindful labyrinth that they walk through. And, what they do is they take a little stone and, they think about with the stone in their hand, just as an exercise, sort of they set an intention for the day. And with that, they walk through the labyrinth and place it in the middle, where there's a little, bucket, in the middle that they put in. And then they walk out and then they walk to school. So that sort of sets their day off. So they start their day with that in mind. Once they go to school, they have they do their normal school session. It is an alternative school. So it may not be, they have more recess and each classroom is different, catered to the grade that they're in and to the learning style of each individual. And that's a whole nother, another program from the residential, which I mostly work in. Mm-hmm. So we tend to have a few hours off during the day as a house parent, although there's usually something we need to do on campus, chores or paperwork or something to figure out, with the school. And then in the afternoon we pick them up and, we basically provide a family, lifestyle for them, with some structure, of course. We walk back, we have a snack, and then we have some free time for them or a scheduled activity, whatever it may be, bike riding, hiking around, some sort of interactive game, something like that. And then we cook dinner and have a family dinner and then have an evening activity. And then we put them to bed. Usually we'll read a group story or usually there's two house parents in each house. So we'll go one-on-one and each read them a story or have a group depending. It could be a little different each day. But that's about a general day
It sounds idyllic. But, I know that very often – these kids, these are kids who literally can't make it in public school and very often can't even make it in a normal home, in their family home.
Yep.
A lot of them have explosive rage issues, problems being on the autistic spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the challenges that you face?
Well, there's a lot of different types of kids. So there's a lot of different styles of those kind of behaviors that could come up. But, we do deal with these children being so sensitive to their surroundings. They could have outbursts sometimes for no reason, often it is for a good reason, at least from their perspective. But we might not often know. We'll have to figure out maybe even after we get them back into a state of mind where they can be rational. Mm-hmm. Because they get themselves, and even as adults, we just learn to sort of cover it up. We might have, some feeling of anger or distaste towards something in our lives, but children don't have the structure in their brain developed yet to be able to handle that externally. So they display that in a visual way that we can all see. And, we take care of that. Hopefully we don't have to restrain them. We do have to actually physically hold them sometimes, but that's only if they're being actually unsafe to themselves or others or destroying something. Ideally, we can sort of get them in a space where they can calm down and then in a calm state of mind, they return to their rationality and they're able to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when we kind of have a restorative process where we learn from the experience and through that process, they're able to see more rationally and see clearly how maybe in the future they could work on that when that feeling comes.
Tell me about, you said mindfulness early on, the maze and, what do you call it, labyrinth and, talk about mindfulness in relation to the way you're working with these kids.
Well, ideally, we're trying to teach them how, these style of children, whether they're ADD, ADHD, or Asperger's, or some other undefined you know, problem they may have inside. We try to teach them how strongly their mind can affect, you know, the way they feel. So the idea with the labyrinth is that it gives them a moment to realize how strongly their mind and their intentions can project the outcome of their day. So by starting them off in that quiet moment, walking through the labyrinth with that one thing in mind, or, you know, letting their mind roam free, you know, well within the confines of the labyrinth. The labyrinth allows, you know, your decision-making part of your brain to take a rest for a moment, because the labyrinth automatically guides you into the center. So during that time, they can quietly walk through and they sort of have a moment where all those other distractions don't necessarily have to be bothering them. And they can only focus on either nothing or, you know, whatever comes to them, or specifically that intention. So that brings them to a place where, you know, they may not even realize it's happening, but it brings them to a place of understanding how powerful their thoughts can be.
How do I resign from the board of directors and become one of the kids?
Sounds great.
I'm just joking. But you're doing great work, Ryan. I know, and it's difficult work. I've been there and done it, and I really, really honor what you're doing. Thanks so much for coming on the air today and sharing your story and the Hunter School story with us and our viewers and listeners. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Ryan Barber, he's a house parent at the Hunter School. The website is hunterschool.org, and if you would like to donate to help Ryan keep doing the great work he's doing, and the program keep going, 800-897-8358 or hunterschool.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
That's the Hunter School. It's hunterschool.org or salemchildrensvillage.org, 800-897-8358. Bad of the very, very joko, seriously ugly, brought to you by the organic wine company, ecowine.com. The good, Port Clinton, Ohio. Residents of this Toledo suburb celebrated Christmas earlier than usual this year to help cheer up 13-year-old David Coleman, who is terminally ill with brain cancer. On Sunday afternoon, hundreds of his neighbors and friends welcomed him home from the hospital with a massive Christmas party in the town square. WTOL covered the story for local TV.
They came out in their red and green, all decked out for Christmas. For Devin Coleman, a 13-year-old Port Clinton boy who has been given weeks to live.
Decided at 10 o'clock this morning that we wanted to decorate this and make something special so that as he's looking across the street from his window, he could see this. And within an hour, we had probably about 50, 60 people here bringing decorations plus what the city had.
And it turned into this. A winter wonderland all right across the street from his house. They sing carols and launch balloons so Devin can enjoy the holidays this year as well.
David Coleman may now be alive come Christmas time. The Christmas spirit is definitely alive and well right now in Port Clinton. The bad. George Zimmerman, America's most famous acquitted killer, finds himself today in more controversy in the wake of accusations that he threatened his estranged wife. According to a new report, Zimmerman left a gun target riddled with bullet holes on the wall of his wife's house. He and his wife had apparently been fighting beforehand. Is this guy a walking, talking advertisement for gun control or what? And the very, very ugly, Rafael Cruz. The father of Tea Party crusader Ted Cruz was already infamous for calling President Obama a Muslim. Now it appears that he's a full-on birther. Mother Jones has released a video of the elder Cruz, who is an evangelical pastor, speaking at a Tea Party event last September. During that video, Rafael Cruz urges his audience to, quote, send the president back to Kenya. Check it out.
So I'll tell you, we have our work cut out for us. We need to send Barack Obama back to Chicago. I'd like to send him back to Kenya, back to Kenya.
I don't know what's worse, that Ted Cruz's dad actually thinks that Obama's from Kenya, or that people applaud him for saying so. Both are very, very ugly. It's incredible. Lucky the dog. Great post over to you today. Key takeaways from yesterday's healthcare hearings on Capitol Hill. Did you watch any of this? Did you check this out? You know, the Republicans, they were, you know, all full of sturm und drang and you know, going after Kathleen Sebelius and the president said that you can keep your health care plan. I got this health care plan, and, you know, it says that they can just cancel me anytime they want if I get sick. But I want to keep this plan. Why? And so, anyhow, Lucky the Dog writes, Republicans just discovered that the Affordable Care Act doesn't – now, I wouldn't have written this with double negatives in it because it makes it a little confusing. But anyhow, discovered that the ACA doesn't forbid private health insurers from eliminating scam-like low-value health insurance policies that were written too recently to be grandfathered in and exempted from new regulations. As usual – in other words, the Republicans just discovered that these basically – the healthcare versions of subprime mortgages, exploding health insurance plans. Republicans just discovered that you can't keep those. The health insurance companies can't continue selling crappy products. As usual, Lucky the Dog writes, they are outraged. They were. Did you hear it yesterday? There was that one member of Congress. What was his name? I had the story here yesterday. Anyhow, this is one member of Congress who just went totally nutso about, you know, he was waving it around. I've got this health insurance plan, and I just got a cancellation notice. How dare you? You said I could keep my insurance. Well, that's not really an insurance policy you have. That's money that the insurance company will take from you until you get sick, and then they will tell you where to go. And it won't be the hospital. Anyhow, number one. Number two, Republicans just discovered that cabinet-level federal employees get, you know, like Kathleen Sebelius, get employer-sponsored health insurance, and that the law doesn't let them transfer their employer contribution to the exchanges. Oh, my goodness! More outrage. Another thing that we learned, that the, you know, the key takeaways from yesterday's health care hearings on Capitol Hill, apparently they weren't paying attention when Medicare Part D rolled out and there were all those problems and hiccups and things didn't work, or for that matter, Romney Care, when that rolled out in Massachusetts. They apparently were not paying any attention. Extreme outrage. Maybe they didn't notice when Windows rolled out either. I mean, you know. Okay. Apparently, this is another one. Apparently the government, as far as Republicans know, has never before brought technology that didn't work right first time and cost, you know, just exactly what it was supposed to cost. Apparently, the government's never had any technology cost more than was expected, and has never had any technology not work the first time. Apparently, they don't know about the V-22 Osprey or the F-35, right? Or maybe they think those are made up by the great liberal conspiracy. Good job, Lucky the Dog, of pulling this stuff together. Robert Reich comes out and says, you know, all these problems, if you're really going to get bent out of shape about it, isn't this a good opportunity to put a public option in the health insurance plan? I mean, in Obamacare, if you want to fix Obamacare, you Republicans who are so upset about it, why don't you put a public option in there? Let Medicare compete. Just say, okay, one of the options you can choose is Medicare regardless of your age. Robert Reich didn't make that suggestion. I did, but he was, you know, speaking in the larger sense. The CEO of WellPoint said the long-term membership growth opportunity through exchange is great, you know. Stephen J. Hemsley, CEO of United Health Group, he says the emergence of public health exchanges, private exchanges, Medicaid expansions have the potential to create new opportunities for us to grow and serve in new ways. Have you noticed that the stock price of the health insurance companies has been going up? So why are Republicans so upset about this? And this is where over at DU, KP points out the incredible irony. If the Democrats had, you know, stuck with the original Democratic vision, you know, which was single pay, you know, Medicare for all. John Conyers, House Resolutions, I think it's 676, he brings it up every year, year after year after year, just drop the Medicare eligibility age to zero. Everybody in the country qualifies for Medicare. And it would actually reduce the costs of and for Medicare. Because people under 65 tend to be healthier than people over 65. So Medicare for everybody in the country would reduce the costs of Medicare for everybody. So had, you know, if Democrats had stuck with that, it would have been cheaper, it would have been simpler, it would have been more widely accepted. But the Republicans wouldn't go along with that. So the Democrats brought us Romney Care, thinking, okay, you know, and in fact, Romney originally said, I understand the president's going to emulate Massachusetts. I congratulate him on that. He said that before he said, I never said Massachusetts should be the same as everybody else in the country. So the bottom line is you can't please Republicans. You know, Louise and I were last night watching, I forget what show it was, but it was some show on one of the news shows. And it was a clip of President Obama giving a speech. And he was talking about how the Republicans have basically obstructed everything. And, I turned to Louise and I said, you know, if I was him, I would be so angry. I mean, they've sabotaged his presidency for 5 years with some considerable success. The things that he has wanted to do that would have put our economy back on track, they have prevented him from doing. I mean, Nancy Pelosi actually got out of the House of Representatives a bill that the president very much wanted to sign that would have stopped tax breaks for companies that send jobs overseas. Republicans in the Senate filibustered it. I mean, think about that for a minute. The Republicans don't want to bring jobs home. Why? Because you've got a Democrat in the White House. Now, when George Bush was president and the Republicans were looking for some way to play Santa Claus, you know, back to Judah Wodinsky's two Santa Claus theory that the Democrats always get to be Santa Claus, right? The Democrats brought us Social Security. Democrats brought us Medicare. Democrats brought us unemployment insurance. Democrats brought us the minimum wage, always over the objection of Republicans. That Republicans have to figure out a way to be Santa Claus. And the way that Judah Wodinsky suggested and Ronald Reagan did was cut taxes. He cut the top tax rate on millionaires and billionaires from 74% down to 28%. And in fact, it's at 20% right now. If you like Mitt Romney, if you make your money with money. So Wodinsky said, you know, Republicans have to figure out a way to be Santa Claus. Well, they've cut taxes as much as they possibly can. I mean, taxes are absurdly low right now. Tax collections are like where they were in, you know, the 50s, in a recession during the 50s. So during the Bush administration, they said, okay, let's be Santa Claus the way Democrats have been Santa Claus. Let's give seniors a drug benefit, Medicare Part D. Now, we're going to do it in a way that our friends in the pharmaceutical industry are going to make $600 billion in extra money because the government can't negotiate prices, but we're going to offer a benefit. They did it, and the Democrats said, okay, we'll help you implement that. But the Republicans are not helping the Democrats implement Obamacare.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And people say there's no difference between the parties. I mean, I'd give you a long list of my critiques of the Democratic Party, but there is a difference. Welcome back. Ed in Saginaw, Michigan, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. Hey, Ed, what's on your mind today?
Oh, I was just wondering. I'm retired from GM. And now that Blue Cross, Blue Shield is saying they're not going to pick up anything for office visits or anything. Just let Medicare pay for everything.
Really?
Yeah.
So as part of your retirement package, what presumably you gave up some of your pay back in the day when you were working for GM in exchange for health care after you retired. Am I correct in that?
Well, yes. Oh, yes. They had 60 or $70 billion in there for the retirees. Congress passed a law about 15, 20 years ago and saying that each employer got to put so much away for the employees, retirement.
Right.
Well, I guess when they filed bankruptcy, they took that all away.
That's right. That's how they do it. They use the bankruptcy laws. And in fact, they changed the bankruptcy laws during the Bush administration to make it even easier, although it's they first changed that law in the 80s during the Reagan administration to make it possible for vulture capitalists like Mitt Romney to come in and buy a company and then strip it of its pension funds or of its pension or health retirement benefits. So you've got Medicare plus you've got Blue Cross as a secondary through your retirement from GM, and Blue Cross is now saying tough luck, Charlie. Really?
Yeah.
Did they send you a letter or what?
They said in the new trust now they only let Medicare pay for the 80% and they don't pick up anything else.
So why even have
Blue Shield?
Blue Cross Blue Shield is giving you health insurance, presumably kind of a Medigap insurance policy. What are they paying for? If they pay for nothing, then how can they call it insurance?
I don't know. I gotta get to the bottom of this and find out what's going on. But I mean, it's just we should go in the free market then. You know, if it's going to be cheaper and they'll pay more.
Yeah. Well, what free market is that? You mean on the exchanges?
Right. Because I'm under Medicare.
Yeah. 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 I think what you need to be looking into is a Medigap insurance policy. You know, I hate to say it. Actually, what we all need to be looking into is lobbying as citizens, our members of the House of Representatives and the United States Senate, to change Medicare so that there is no need for Medigap coverage, so that Medicare covers all health insurance for people over 65. And then if you really want to get it, you know, go crazy, suggest that we drop the eligibility age from 65 down to 55. Actually, drop it 10 years by 10 years every year. So drop it to 55 next year, drop it to 45 the year after that, drop it to 35 the year after that. That way each year the Medicare system has, you know, because it's already there and it's already working and their website does work, the Medicare system has the ability to ramp up a little bit, you know, every year to take in the new people. And you know, over a six-year period, you would end up, or a seven-year period, I guess, you'd end up covering everybody in the United States. Makes sense?
Correct.
Yeah,
I understand that. Yeah,
yeah. I think we should do it. I'm amazed. Ed, have you talked to your union reps about this?
Well, I called Blue Cross Blue Shield, and I tried. The union hall's closed right now. I got a bill, and it said for all they paid was 80% of the doctor. Blue Cross and Blue Shield didn't pick up nothing for the doctor.
Right. Okay. Well, good luck on getting to the bottom of that one, there, Ed. And thanks a lot for the call. And you know, good on you for you know, being a good union worker all those years. It's a shame that the banksters, basically, the Mitt Romneys of the world, got to rob you. Sorry to hear that. 10 minutes before that. Wines have some of the highest pesticide levels in our food chain. EcoWine.com, the organic wine company, has pesticide-free wines. That's EcoWine.com. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by, and Ellen was in here yesterday, and she said, you know, for the next couple of days, Ellen's actually on the board of directors of Hunter School along with me. She said, have our sponsorship be Hunter School. So brought to you by our fundraising drive at the Hunter School, 800-897-8358 or hunterschool.org if you would like to donate, and please do. Bob Ney. Hey, Bob.
How are you?
I am fine. And I should add, former Congressman Bob Ney and author of the book that explains how Washington, D.C. works, Sideswiped, and also lays out John Boehner's crimes, actual crimes, high crimes and misdemeanors. Anyhow, Bob, what's going on in the world?
Well, there is a new subpoena, and you know who it's from. You can guess that one. Congressman Issa of California, House Oversight and the Government Reform Committee, has subpoenaed documents today from Health and Human Services Department related to the website. I'm not sure, Tom, what they think they know or what they're digging into, but it's on the heels of the Secretary's hearing yesterday, obviously, Sebelius, but he has now subpoenaed that.
Have you no shame, Congressman?
I don't understand. I don't know what they think they have.
He's trying so hard to out Joe McCarthy, you know?
And the other committee chairmen, because he didn't get his round at this, I guess.
Oh, yeah. He hasn't had an opportunity to grandstand on Obamacare. So
he has to do something. That's the way the system works out there.
Yeah, of course. And he's probably got a fundraising letter going out along with it.
So that is going to be I don't know if they'll actually be able to bring the secretary back in or if he'll go to that level.
Oh, remember when Nancy Pelosi subpoenaed Karl Rove to appear before Congress? And
they used the
He went to Yalta to meet with Saakashvili, who then stirred everything up with Russia just in time for the for John McCain's election.
Yes, and then they didn't have to talk, and they had the cloaking devices I called from the White House instituted. The rest was history.
Yes.
It just never went.
Yes.
And Don Siegelman's case, he just used a cloaking device again.
That's right. It's amazing. It's amazing what they get away with, or what Karl Rove has gotten away with. I mean, that's a book in and of itself.
And then, of course, the NSA has Google was very upset in Yahoo. I think the most interesting story that broke, though, was the fact of did they – they said they didn't, but did they or did they not do the pre-Pope wiretap with Pope Francis at the conclave? The Italian magazine is saying that they did do that.
That the NSA is spying on the Pope, too.
Yes, they said it. They have published that in an Italian magazine, and the NSA has denied that. But, Snowden just has so many things out there that he's constantly releasing. It's weekly. And the new one is where they tapped in, with the help of Britain this time, into the international pipeline of all the outgoing and incoming Google and Yahoo information.
Right. So it's not just your email. It's also every website you visit. Is that?
I believe all of that data is within there. And they have the ability. Now, they said they have done nothing unlawful, so I don't know what grounds they took it or what data they, who knows what they kept or they didn't keep. But
right.
I just thought it was fascinating. It's another release from Snowden. You know, one thing I wanted to mention, and this is pretty high level, and this is really major, and it's getting some attention, but not, I think, to the level of its importance. Our Secretary Kerry of the State Department is up on Capitol Hill today, as is our Vice President Biden, and they are both trying to get the Senate to not do round two right now of the Iranian sanctions due to some delegate negotiations.
Mm-hmm.
And I mention this, Tom, because the right wing right, the neocon right, is salivating. Dick Cheney actually, I think, used the words about bombing Iran.
Yeah.
But they're salivating about doing round two right now, which would be severe and could possibly break down all the communications that have been built up by President Obama after 30 years of going nowhere. And so,
and you were involved in this. You were at the time the only member of Congress who speaks Farsi, who speaks the Persian language, the Iranian language.
Yes, and I ran up against the State Department's unknown head of the Iran desk, whose last name was Cheney, Dick Cheney's daughter. And
oh, really?
Yes, that one never got much.
Was that Liz?
Yes, it was. She was head of the Iran desk. And so when I had to do things, obviously, with sensitive things that we were helping to communicate at the time that were of very importance to the United States.
As a Republican on behalf of the Bush administration.
That's right. Well, we had to go up against Cheney at the Iran desk.
Amazing.
I thought that was fascinating. Yes.
Amazing. As a Republican congressman on behalf of the Bush administration trying to work out peace with Iran, you got stymied or stifled or headbutted or whatever the phrase is by Lynn Cheney?
Yes, at the Iran desk.
Or Liz Cheney. Amazing. Amazing. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I think it's important to mention that the Obama administration is trying to say to them, look, you can implement these. You can implement these sanctions. It doesn't have to be done today. They've taken some delicate steps to try to get Iran to, obviously not go nuclear.
Right.
And this could really, the neocon element is behind all of this in the Senate.
Are these sanctions the sort of thing that are just like normal legislation? In other words, they have to pass the House and Senate and then be signed by the president. Could he refuse to sign them?
Yes, he could. The House passed it already.
Okay, and, so it's at the Senate.
So they did it. Yeah, they've already passed it. They did it in July. And it's sitting, and Mark Kirk is behind this in the Senate in a huge, huge way.
He's the senator from where?
Oh,
Illinois? Is he the Republican?
Yes.
Yeah.
He was in the House, and I should know what state.
Yeah.
I'm getting blank on it.
Shane says he's pretty sure it's Illinois.
Yes, it is Illinois.
So he'd be Dick Durbin's colleague. Although Dick Durbin is a Democrat and a good guy, Mark Kirk is apparently a wackadoodle.
Way out there.
It's incredible. So call your senators and tell them not to pass sanctions on Iran until the president says to do so, because he's negotiating with them and he's trying to make things work so that we don't have another war in the Middle East.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Bob Ney. Hey, Bob, is there a website for your book, Sideswiped?
Yeah, it's Amazon.com.
Yeah, okay. Well, of course, you can buy it there. But, you know, you need to put up a website that we can point people to, you know. Nice picture of Bob, you know, your story, something like that. Anyhow, thank Bob you. Ney, his book, Sideswipe, Talk Radio News. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Peter Schweitzer is on the line with us. He's a fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University and president of the Government Accountability Institute, the author of a new book, Extortion, How Politicians Extract Your Money, Buy Votes, and Line Their Own Pockets. His website, Peter Schweitzer, without a T, Peter Schweizer, although you pronounce it as if there was a T, .com. Peter, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. You know, we disagree on a few things politically and worldview-wise, but I think that I think you're onto something really fascinating here about how politicians. We may disagree on why this is, but which is a whole other issue. But how politicians are basically picking our pockets. Lay out your premise for us.
Yeah, well, basically my premise is that, you know, our approach to money in politics for the last 40 years or so has largely been that we've got to protect politicians from outside influences. And I certainly agree with that. But I think it's been exclusively that. My basic premise and belief is that we also have to erect defenses or create reforms that prevent politicians, in a sense, from extorting money. That the problem is not so much just bribery, but it's actually extortion, where they are creating circumstances where they can leverage their position and power that basically compels industries or companies who ordinarily wouldn't give to candidates to feel like they have to.
Give me an example.
Well, an example would be the high-tech industry. You know, this happened to Microsoft in the late 1990s. I think you could argue it happened to Google here more recently. In the high-tech sector, basically, they are focused on innovating. They are focused on, you know, a very, very highly competitive market. Not that they don't care what happens in Washington, they do. But I think there was a pretty concerted effort by politicians from both parties to say, look, you need to be interested in what we're doing. You may not be interested in Washington, but Washington's interested in you. And I even quote in my book a statement from Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah, you know, who said, if you want to go into business, you need to be interested in politics. There are a lot of businessmen who don't agree with that, but basically they're put into a situation where they have to.
Well, here's a chicken and egg situation. I mean, you've got companies like Comcast, you know, the big cable companies, and this is a story you won't hear on MSNBC because they're owned by Comcast. But you've got companies like Comcast that, you know, are pushing for legislation that allows them, since they're one of the largest internet service providers in the country, you know, many people in this country get their internet service through Comcast, that would allow them to say, okay, we're going to meter your service, we're going to charge, you know, if you're going to have a website on there, if you're going to do commercial activity as opposed to non-commercial activity, we are going to be able to look at what you're doing and charge you based on what you're doing. And, you know, which is even more draconian than the phone company. I mean, the phone company used to say, if you want to call from New York to New Jersey, that doesn't cost you as much as calling from New York to San Francisco. But they never said, if you want to call from New York to New Jersey, well, actually, they did for a while. You used to have to get a business phone if you were a business. And if you were, and if you had a personal phone, which was cheaper, you know, I remember starting a business back in the 70s and using a personal line and getting busted by the phone company. They said, no, no, you've got to have a business line. You got to pay extra for that. So, you know, Comcast is trying to do that. They're trying to say, we're going to charge extra for this. And then on the other hand, you've got big businesses like Google and Microsoft who are saying, no, and Amazon.com and whatnot, New York Times, who are saying, wait a minute, we're doing our business on the Internet, and a lot of small companies, too. We're doing our business on the Internet. We don't want to be charged extra just because that happens to be the place we're doing business. So both of them are going to members of Congress and saying, put forward legislation that will protect our interests from the other guy. They each find legislators to buy. The legislators introduce the legislation. From your worldview, the legislators did that from the get-go in order to squeeze money out of these companies. But it seems to me like the companies just as easily could have started this process.
Oh, no, there's no question, Tom. You're right. There are businesses that come all the time that they're looking for government to sort of serve their ends. I think the problem is that all the incentives, though, in the case that you just laid out, all the incentives for what I call the political class, and that is people from both political parties, is to drag this thing out. They really don't have a financial incentive to solve this problem, because so long as it lingers and festers, they can drag it out, they can continue to extract donations, lobbying gigs for family and friends, etc. So, yes, there's no question that industries come. They're looking for special favors. They're looking for special benefits. I personally call that crony capitalism, where they're looking for the government basically to do their bidding.
I would agree with that.
Yes, but I think the problem is that you know, they like to pit industries against each other. And as, you know, I interviewed a former corporate executive, President of Shell Oil, who said, you know, if you look at the business model of the political class, there's no money to be made in solving problems. Because when you solve problems, it's harder to raise money. It's harder to get lobbying contracts for families and friends, et cetera.
Yeah, well, this is one of the complaints that I heard very loudly at a CPAC convention in it was one of the presidential election years. I think it was 2008, where one of the speakers, who was an anti-abortion speaker, was saying, you know, the Republicans all the time tell us that they're going to outlaw abortion, but then we vote them into office, we give them power, and they don't do it. And I think that they don't do it because they want to continue begging for donations from us anti-abortion Republicans. And,
yeah.
And that person got a fairly hearty round of applause at CPAC. I mean, I was there in the room when that happened.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think there are lots of people that can say that, not only that are issue driven, you know, whether it's environmental groups or you know, social conservatives. I think a lot of companies can say that, too. I mean, for example, take the tax code, set aside the policy questions, you know, about some of the tax credits and things that are around there lurking. Something like the research and development tax credit, which has been around since 1981, that the high tech industry uses for, you know, renovation and basic research and development. It never gets extended for more than 1 or 2 years. Well, why is that? It's because if they extended it for 10 years, they couldn't go back to those companies and say, hey, we're thinking about doing this, but you better pony up.
Yeah.
So it's this industrial
model. So what's the solution, Peter? You've identified a very real problem in my mind. And I've read your book, or at least most of it. It seems to me that the solution is to say that the Supreme Court is wrong and that money is not free speech. You disagree with that. What's your alternative proposal?
Well, I think these guys are pretty clever, unfortunately, and they're always going to find out ways around it. But I think that one of the things we can do, for me, it's not just a question of the money contributions to the politicians. It's a question of the timing of those.
No, but you said this has really been only going on for about 40 years. I mean, that tracks back to the Buckley case when the Supreme Court first said money is speech.
Right. Right. And I think, you know, that's a legal question that the lawyers are going to fight out, whether the court was right or wrong. I think that given the situation we're in right now, one reform that we should look at is putting regulations or controls on the ability of politicians to solicit donations. So let's do in Washington what's done in 27 states, including the state of Washington, the state of Florida, the state of Texas, and elsewhere, which is they say that state legislators cannot solicit or receive campaign contributions when the state legislature is in session, period. Were we to do that in Washington, Tom, I can guarantee you two things would happen. Number one, they would be terribly efficient with their time in D.C. because they would be looking to go out and head back to their districts and raise money. So it would force them to stop a lot of the shenanigans that they do right now to gin up the possibility for raising donations.
But wouldn't they just create PACs that would do it on their behalf? I mean, wouldn't Karl Rove just start raising the money instead and then passing it out to people he likes?
Yes, they certainly could. I mean, you have the issue that the courts have determined that, you know, individuals, as you said, can and will and are able to, you know, be politically active. So that's always going to be an issue. But I think the more compelling one for me is the actual funding of the candidates themselves, because that's where I think you get into the quid pro quo. When corporations come to guys and say, look, we'll raise you a lot of money. We need you to do us a very particular favor.
I think, Peter, every American would agree with you that we have a serious problem. And your book, Extortion, How Politicians Extract Your Money, Buy Votes, and Line Their Own Pockets, is a great start opening the door. PeterSchweitzer.com. Thank you, Peter, for dropping by.
Thanks so much, Tom. I appreciate it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I mean, how we solve that problem, that's another conversation that needs to be had. I think we go to movetoamend.org, start a local chapter. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Walter in Manchester, Pennsylvania, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Walter, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. Appreciate you having the show on.
Sure.
Peter Schweitzer, this is the man that we need to have in D.C.
Well, wait a second. Peter is a Republican.
Well,
he's a conservative.
You know, he just talked right there. The gentleman you were talking to seemed to have some pretty good common sense.
He does, and he's identified a problem, but he's unwilling to say, therefore, we should say that we should regulate money. He's unwilling to say that. His solution is to say that members of Congress can't solicit money when Congress is not in session. They'll just be more aggressive when it's in session. I disagree with his solution. I think he's done a good job of identifying the problem. Or a problem, part of the problem, and in that regard, we can all agree. But Peter and I are, very politically different. And anyway,
he's onto a topic there.
He's got a good book. I mean, it's a good starting point. It's just, then you get to the question of what do we do about it, and we go off in different directions.
Okay, I was just giving him a little congrats there. I didn't want to spend too much time.
That's fine. That you called about something else.
My point was this: the Republicans and the Democrats, they work basically for the same guys. And, they're putting up this front, it seems, to us because, all they do is talk. Let's get down to the work. I'm not sure how they can sit back and watch humanity, crumble. We're not looking for handouts, Everybody I know works. And there's a lot of people that need help.
Yeah.
And there should be some good common sense, bottom line ways of helping people. I mean, if we can send man to the moon and if we can explore Mars, we can feed people. So let's choose. That should be the bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
You understand? I mean,
I do. I would say that because the Supreme Court has changed the rules of the game so that if you're a politician, regardless of your party, you could be a Green or a Libertarian or whatever. If you're a politician, you have to have rich donors or you have to raise a lot of money from a lot of people if you're going to get reelected, period. I mean, it's just that simple. And in fact, now the value of radio and television stations in swing states is measurably greater than the value of radio and television stations in non-swing states, even though they have the exact same listening audience, just because the Supreme Court has changed the rules of the game. So, yes, we have a broken system and both parties are exploiting it or benefiting from it. That said, though, what you will find is that the Democrats at least give lip service to, and when they're in power, give actual voice to we the people. I mean, the Democrats at least are going to try and keep Medicare in place and Social Security in place. The Republicans would like to hand both. They'd like to hand Medicare over to UnitedHealthcare and Social Security over to Bank of America.
Yeah, well, I am a registered Democrat.
Yeah, me too. Walter, thank you very much for the call. I need to find out. Thank you, Walter. I appreciate it. I live here in Washington, D.C. I don't know if we have open primaries or closed primaries. I'm pretty sure when I registered to vote, when we moved here, that I registered as a Democrat on the assumption that there were closed primaries. But I don't know. I need to look that up, because if they're open primaries, I should just re-register as an independent. Anyhow, 20 minutes past. It's Thursday. It's that three-minute time every week when Louise and Sean let me have 3 minutes to talk about science, one of my favorite topics. How would you like some crushed caterpillars with your curry powder? Or some ragged rat hairs with your rosemary? How about some maggots with your mustard seeds? Yuck, right? Well, next time you go shopping for spices at the supermarket, that might be exactly what you're getting. According to a new report on imported spice, a new report by the FDA, around 12% of spices imported to the United States are contaminated with insect parts, whole insects, rodent hairs, and all sorts of cool stuff like that. The FDA also found that almost 7% of spice imports that were studied were contaminated with salmonella, a toxic bacteria that causes food poisoning. These findings released yesterday mark the culmination of a comprehensive FDA study on U.S. spice imports. Spice imports from Mexico and India were found to have the highest rate of contamination, which is pretty scary considering that almost a quarter of the spices, oils, and food colorings Americans use come from India. After reading their findings, the FDA said that spice contamination is a systemic challenge, and that most of the insects found in spices were the kind of insects that thrive in warehouses and storage facilities, suggesting that the spice industry's problems result not so much from poor storage practices, poor storage practices and not so much from bad harvesting practices. Thanks to some recent legislation in Washington, the FDA now has the power to refuse the import and sale of foods or spices that it thinks might be contaminated. So hopefully they'll be able to use that power to clean up and force the global spice industry to clean up its practices. But until that happens, spice might not be so nice. So, Bruce, in Arvada, Colorado, you are a nuclear engineer and you want to educate me about zirconium.
Yes, let me get you off speakerphone.
Thank you.
Sorry about that.
That's quite all right.
Yes, in fact, nuclear engineer, operated nuclear power plants for many years for the Navy, so not commercial industry. I know a little bit about nuclear engineering and nuclear reactor design. This is well after the fact for your conversation. I think it was with Arnie Gunderson.
No, it was with Kevin Camps.
Okay, apologies.
And my question to Kevin, and apparently I was operating under incorrect information, was, you know, because I've read about zirconium tubing bursting into flames, and I didn't know what the ignition temperature was, and I thought it might be something close to room temperature because they continue to cool the stuff, and he said, no, it's 2,000 degrees.
First of all, zirconium as a metal is not spontaneously combustible.
Even at 2,000 degrees?
That's not spontaneous combustion.
I see. Okay.
In
other words, it won't combust at room temperature.
No, and not even close to room temperature.
Sure.
Now, metal filings might. Further on, the metal tubes are not pure zirconium. They're an alloy.
Right.
Which would also mitigate some of that damage.
Okay.
Just listening to some of the conversations, just inaccurate information that's put out there.
Right. Now, isn't it true, though, that those fuel pellets inside those zirconium tubes, if they are damaged and they get, you know, closer to each other in ways they shouldn't be, that they might produce a fission reaction that exceeds 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit, the combustion temperature of the zirconium, and they might catch the tubes on fire?
Well, if you have a fission reaction, you have other problems than zirconium.
Uh-huh.
But
if it's rapid enough, you have an explosion. But if it's slow, it just produces heat, right?
No, you won't get an explosion. You might get a critical mass that creates a small isolated nuclear reaction, which will create significant problems. I'm not trying to minimize that.
Yeah.
But geometrically and from an engineering standpoint, they're designed not to happen. As a matter of fact, the fuel pellets themselves are not pure fissionable material.
Right. So my understanding is that the biggest problem is hydrogen gas, right?
Nope, that's not true either.
Okay,
hydrogen
set me straight.
Gas comes about as a result of a nuclear chemical reaction with the zirconium tubes, but that would occur at a very, 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 very high temperature, much higher than what you would get.
So what caused the nuclear, what caused the hydrogen bubbles that blew out either four or five of the eight reactors at Fukushima?
Well, first of all, that's not confirmed that there were hydrogen bubbles. It is possible.
What caused the explosions, then, if it wasn't hydrogen?
Gas buildup, maybe. Just pure pressure gas buildup, potentially.
But there were flames. I mean, they've got video of, there were fireballs associated with those.
Okay, can't speak to that. You've got me there.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen the video. Go ahead.
No, I'm not gonna buy that one. That could be something else burning. The point being is
could be.
That the Fukushima accident has not been thoroughly analyzed. And that probably won't happen for years.
I said I don't disagree with you.
Okay. Do you remember back in 1979, the Three Mile Island accident?
I remember it well. I remember going to see the China Syndrome, and then it happened like a week after I saw the movie. It was bizarre.
I know. It was bizarre, but China Syndrome and Three Mile Island were completely unrelated, although, you know, it was understandable how they could have been connected.
It was like, you know, the timing was like the universe was trying to tell us something.
Okay. Just to put it into perspective, again, I have a nuclear engineering degree. I graduated in 1979. Imagine going into the student union. Oh, by the way, I graduated from the same school as Arne Gunderson,
mm-hmm.
although I think he preceded me, at least looking at his resume, by 5 or 6 years. Anyway, imagine going into the student union in the year, just a couple of months before you're going to graduate, with a nuclear engineering degree, and seeing that there's a big problem at Three Mile Island.
Right, that's
turns out back to the point. Remember back then, big scare about a hydrogen bubble.
Right,
and that never occurred.
Yeah, I recall that there was never a hydrogen explosion there. Although there's a debate about how much radioactive iodine might have been released, but it's still a debate apparently. Bruce, thank you for the call. Thanks for listening to AM 760. And thanks for the information. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Let me riff a little bit when we come back from the break about why we create electricity and thus why nuclear energy might not be the best. 28 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, I promised a brief conversation. And then we got a board full of calls. I'll pick up your calls in just a minute. But this is really an important issue, and it's a subset of the Fukushima meltdown. You know, should we have nuclear power issue or problem or whatever? And that is the question: why do we have electric power plants? You know, nobody ever asked that question. It's like, well, obviously we have electric power plants because we need electricity. Well, why do you need electricity? Well, we need electricity so that, you know, we can have a higher quality of life. Louise remembers when her grandmother was finally talked into by the rest of the family doing away with the outhouse and building an indoor toilet in the farmhouse in rural Michigan. Her grandmother died a few years ago at the age of 97. It used to be, before Franklin Roosevelt came along and created the Rural Electrification Administration, that if you lived rurally, you had no electricity. I'm talking about the 20th century. In fact, the mid-20th century. And the reason why was because the power companies said, it's not profitable to run power all the way out to your house. We'll make all our money in the cities where we can run a short wire and we can charge all this money. So Franklin Roosevelt came along and said, okay, here's a pile of money, you know, run the lines. That was the REA. But the point is that we have electricity to improve the standard of our living, of the quality of our lives. Now, what's the purpose of government? Well, Thomas Jefferson said life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In other words, the quality of life. Right? Isn't that one of the roles? I mean, doesn't government have a responsibility for quality of life? We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. So there's this thing called natural monopolies. A natural monopoly, you know, a monopoly is when there's only one provider of something, right? There's only one company that's doing this. They got a monopoly on it. If Microsoft could successfully put Apple out of business and everybody else, you know, who offers an operating system for a computer, then, you know, they would be a monopoly. The European Union today argues that they're a monopoly anyway, but that's a whole other thing. But a natural monopoly is something like electricity. Electricity is a natural monopoly. If there were four competing power companies in your town, you would not have four wires coming into your house. And, you know, different days of the week, depending on who was offering what price that day, you would switch to different wires. Now you have one wire coming into your house. It's a natural monopoly. Natural monopolies are appropriately the job of government, either to provide or to very heavily regulate. Because when there's a natural monopoly, whoever controls that monopoly has us all by the neck, shall we say. They can, I mean, you've got one electric wire coming into your house. You're paying 7 cents a kilowatt hour. They decide to charge you 40 cents a kilowatt hour. What are you going to do? Good luck. So if the purpose of providing electricity is to the general welfare, to promote happiness, then the purpose of producing electricity should be to serve the people, right? Which is why more than half of all the electricity generated in the United States is generated by publicly owned companies, by power generating stations that are owned by towns, by counties, by states, and in a couple of cases by the federal government. Which raises the question, why would you ever let a private for-profit company generate electricity? Well, you know, because the libertarians and the Republicans have gotten around these laws in a lot of places. I was living in Portland when the city of Portland tried to buy the local electric company. And the local electric company was up for sale. It had been owned by Enron, and it was up for sale. And they put a price on it. I forget what the price was, but let's just say arbitrarily, it was $100 million. And the city said, fine, we'll offer $100 million. They said, no, we refuse to sell it to you. We will only sell it to a for-profit company. It was bizarre. I was there. I was on the radio every day talking about it. And the company won. City tried to sue them. It got sold to another company. They wouldn't sell it to the city, period. They didn't want it to go public. Bad precedent. Right? The industry didn't want it to go public. So, which brings us around to nuclear power. If the purpose of generating electricity is to serve the public good, then why would you generate electricity, regardless of how profitable it might be, in a way that could possibly threaten the public good? Why would you generate electricity in a way that could lead to a Chernobyl or a Fukushima? This is the question that the Germans were asking themselves 12 years ago. Back about 5 years ago, his last name was Hess. I forget his first name. I want to say Hermann, but I know that that's the author. Anyhow, one of the two German legislators who introduced the legislation that produced all the fact that about a third of all the German houses now have solar panels on their roofs. And that during this last August, there were some days when over half of the electricity in Germany was generated from people's houses' roofs. That legislator and I co-keynoted a conference in Barcelona, Spain. Louise and I spent a week in Barcelona. Boy, that's a cool city, by the way. In any case. And he made the point in his speech that they knew that Germany was going to need a couple of megawatts more of electricity, and that meant they have got coal, but there'd been pretty much a moratorium on building more coal-fired power plants because they couldn't deal with the pollution. And it was getting very, very expensive to scrub that exhaust stack down to the point where it was clean enough to meet European standards. And they didn't have any oil, and they don't have much natural gas. And so what are they going to do? They've been building nuclear power plants since the 50s or the 60s. And so they were going to have to build a couple more nukes. And he said, why do that? You know, the people don't like it, and it represents a potential threat, and it produces a waste product that we don't even yet know how to deal with. We don't have a solution for nuclear waste. So why do this? Why not put solar panels on people's roofs? And so he introduced this legislation. And I think that's the strongest argument against nuclear power of all, is that if you look at the nuclear power stations in the United States, there's a few that are publicly owned, but the vast majority of them are privately owned. It's a for-profit business. And it's a for-profit business that only exists because it's subsidized by you and me, the Price-Anderson Act. The federal government insures nuclear power plants because Lloyd's of London refuses to. If you build a nuclear power plant in the United States, you cannot buy insurance that fully covers that plant for any kind of disaster. You can't buy it. No insurance company in the world will sell it to you. Now, that in and of itself should tell you that this is not necessarily the smartest way to go. But just think of it in these terms. And this is, I mean, we don't have these conversations in America anymore. These are the conversations that used to happen during the era of Nixon and Kennedy. The debate about the public good and whose responsibility it was and where it lay and how it should be executed. If the goal of producing power is to promote life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, to promote the public welfare, the general welfare of the public, then do you do that with nuclear power, or do you do that with coal, or do you do that with solar and wind? I mean, shouldn't the answer be fairly obvious? If we started asking these deeper and more fundamental questions, if we started using these larger frames, frankly, I think a lot of our policies would change, and for the better. So, anyhow, end of rant. Ron in Everett, Washington, listening on KBCS. Hey, Ron, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking the call. Two quick points. I did watch the hearing yesterday, and I noticed a couple things. Number one, and I'm sure this will be a conversation for later, I witnessed several old white men beating up on yet another woman.
Yeah.
And number two,
gleefully.
And they kept talking about the cancellation letters. Well, since Republicans are more responsive when you equate the debate to the commerce or the free market, I think we should rename these cancellation letters simply as recall letters on a faulty product.
Well, that's exactly what they are. You're absolutely right, Ron.
Exactly,
because
and up until now, they've never had to be responsible for it.
Yeah, and in fact, the insurance companies all but say that in the letters. I mean, I've read a couple of the letters, and they say this product no longer meets the standards of the ACA, but we do have a product that does, and we would like to transition you into it.
I mean, if they want to argue for their pre-existing conditions, let them.
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right. These are recalls. These are insurance recalls of faulty products, faulty insurance products. They are not cancellations. Brilliant, Ron. That's a frame that every Democrat in this country should memorize that frame, and it should go absolutely viral. 15 minutes before the end.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And please go to hunterschool.org and make a donation today. Now, please. Welcome back. Mary in Crawfordville, Florida, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Mary, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Well, I was calling in to, this is mainly for the gentleman that was having problem with his insurance going to Medicare only.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran into that when I became eligible for Medicare. And I had insurance through Boeing. And I called them and asked them, I says, well, should I go on Medicare? They said, oh, yeah, that's a really good deal. So when I went on Medicare, they stopped paying anything.
Right.
Because Medicare became my primary.
And
so you know, it's just a way that they have of not paying anything.
Yeah, yeah.
The only thing I do have through them is a prescription plan, which is excellent. So,
yeah.
But this is, you know, if that helps the gentleman any.
Well, and in fact, Danielle was telling me she used to work in the industry, and this, we don't know if this is the most up-to-date information, but she said that typically secondary insurance, like what you're describing you have through Boeing, only pays the same as the primary insurance. And
that's right.
And so if the primary insurance is Medicare and they're paying 80% of your expenses, then your secondary insurance is, oh, yeah, we'll pay up to 80% of the expenses, although those are already covered by Medicare, but we're not going to pay the other 20%. So why even have it?
That's right. And before that, they paid off wonderful. They were a lot better than Medicare. Had I known then what I know now, I would have stuck with just them.
Well, that's interesting. So. Would they allow you to do that after you pass 65?
I don't know.
Yeah, because they,
really,
you know, the other
know.
Thing
probably
is that
not.
until I think January 1st of this year or next year, until the end of this year, insurance companies can basically cancel anybody for any reason, and they won't be able to in the future.
Really?
Yeah, I mean they've always been able
wow.
to. This is why you know 60% of the people who have half of all bankruptcies are caused by somebody getting sick, and 60% of those
right.
bankruptcies are people who had health insurance. And what
right.
typically happens is either the health insurance company doesn't cover all the expenses, or very frequently the health insurance company simply says, okay, we're pulling the plug on your policy. Or if they're in a state where the insurance commissioner is fairly strong and says you can't just pull the plug once the person gets sick, they just start raising the rates. They say, you know, your rate was $700 a month last month. Well, now it's $1,600 a month. Oh, and by the way, next month it's going to be $3,200 a month. And they're eventually going to get their money back. And people, or they're going to get people to quit.
Under Obamacare, can they put a stop to that?
Yes, that's the whole point of Obamacare. Obamacare makes that illegal.
Wonderful.
Yeah, they can no longer dump you when you get sick. They can no longer
Good.
Say, we're not going to pick you up because you once had cancer, or you have high blood pressure, or any other pre-existing condition. They can no longer do that. They have to insure you, and at the same price as everybody else. And they can only make 20% profit or 20% overhead. They can only skim 20% off the top. And so now this is for the whole group, you know, this is for everybody they insure as a company. They have to operate within that 20%. And if they take in more than the 20% that, you know, so the 80% that they're paying out for actual health care, if they take in more and they make more than 20%, they actually have to write rebate checks to all their customers. And that actually kicked in last year. And at the end of this last year, people were getting rebate checks from their insurance companies. They're going, why did I just get this $25 check or this $300 check from, you know, Aetna or whatever? That's why. Mary, there's a lot of good stuff in Obamacare most people don't even know about. Thanks for the call. Ten minutes before the hour. End of the day, Thursday here, the Salem Children's Village and New England Salem Children's Village, SalemChildren'sVillage.org and HunterSchool.org this is our fundraiser. Tomorrow will be our last day. 800-897-8358 is the telephone number, or you can just go to their website, HunterSchool.org, and make a donation. We're trying to replace a roof and get some generators for the houses, and we want to pave a driveway and paint the outside of the school. So, you know, most of our money comes from reimbursements from school districts who are required by law to provide kids with a good education. And so if the kids have to go to a school like ours, then they have to pay. But they set the rates, and those rates are not enough to really run the program. And so we have to go out in the charitable marketplace and say, please help. And so please help. Real simple. 800-897-8358. Steve in Chicago. Hey, Steve, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Thank you. Yes, I want to make 2 points. One with regard to a previous caller who suggested that Secretary Sebelius was being unfairly attacked or wanted to bring gender into the discussion. I would argue that those sorts of points risk infantilizing women, that somehow if Secretary Sebelius had been a man, that, you know, she wouldn't, he or he wouldn't have been attacked. This has to do with the issue, not the gender. And
yeah, that's a legitimate point, Steve. That's a legitimate point.
Thank you. I think it's important we recognize that we don't risk, out of good intentions, you know, turning women into something that, again, is akin to something we saw in the 19th century, that, oh, they're too fragile. They can't possibly hold that position
right.
because, you know, if they get attacked, you know, unlike men.
I got it.
Having said that, the second point, this is absurd in terms of the Republican arguments that, yes, we have a major public policy initiative, an attempt to reform what is, most people agree, is in need of reform, a healthcare system that is broken and spends more per capita than any other Western industrialized nation and gets less back in return in terms of good healthcare.
Right.
So we agree on that, and we want to roll out a plan, which, by the way, is not the plan that would have been the one that I would have opted for, which is single payer. So now you have in a cohort in this country who wants to critique a plan, which is the product of a compromise that they forced upon us. And because this compromise is a piecemeal of all of state and federal law and this sort of thing, of websites that which states, you have state websites, you have federal websites for states that don't choose to participate. So now it's imperfect. A whole month into the process of this huge public policy initiative, one wants to now evaluate this as being a object failure. And it is absurdity beyond absurdity. I mean, if you want to look at large public policy initiatives and exactly how successful they were in the long run versus the initial rollout, the GI Bill, student loans, the interstate highway system, I can go on and on and on. How poorly we were transitioning at the onset of the Second World War from a private sector economy that produced automobiles to one that produced airplanes and tanks, and how poorly that was done in the first year and how much critique there was of that process.
Mm-hmm.
But so this nonsense that, oh, my God, the whole thing is a failure because 1 month in, it isn't perfect. And by the way, it's not perfect in part because the very people who opposed the alternative proposition got their way and created this hodgepodge, which in and of itself had to be imperfect.
Yeah, I got to tell you, Steve, this morning, I start my morning, I get over around 9, 10 o'clock, I get over to the TV studios where we do show prep for the TV show and the radio show, and we have our conference calls and everything out of there, and then I head over here to the radio studio and you know, do the radio show and then head back over there. But the reason I mention that is because at the RTTV studios, they've got, you know, one wall is all these giant, big monitors with all the networks, right? And Fox, there's no sound, you know, but you can see what's on the screen. And Fox this morning had a chyron, you know, that lower third, the big words underneath the guest's face, that said, is the total failure of Obamacare, no, does the total failure of Obamacare, maybe it was abject failure of Obamacare, mean the death of liberalism? Question mark.
Exactly. I mean, and
it's like, really?
Exactly. I mean, these are the same people who were asking a few months back, you know, is this the end of the Republican Party?
Yeah.
You know, after their losses in the last election cycle. And we need to remember that what the Republicans want here is to find a way to delay Obamacare, argue that in the 2014 election cycle that this public policy initiative was a failure. That's why they had to push it back. And so, therefore, obviously, those people who voted for Obama and support the left, you know, they made a mistake. An independent voter should come back to us. Once they come back to us, we can then roll back Obamacare, and we are back at, you know, with square one where we were before Obamacare.
Right.
So make no mistake, this is what they want. They want an excuse. And what we've got to do is stand firm and say, you know what, it may be necessary to compromise. It may be necessary to push back the dates on some of these requirements as to when you need to sign up and so forth, depending upon how well we can.
Well, President Obama just did that. He moved the date back from February 15th to March 1st.
Exactly, and there are a number of dates. That's not the only one, obviously, yeah. But there are in terms of when you're going to be penalized,
right.
You know, when your last day to sign up, you know, all of these sorts of things.
Right.
So, you know, I keep in mind, nothing this grandiose is going to be simple. And again, for those of us who wanted single payer, you know, Medicare was already there. Enrolling everybody would have been relatively simple, and you wouldn't have had these problems. So, you know, anytime someone wants to tell you, you know, look at how much of a failure Obamacare has been. Yes, it wouldn't have been if we had gotten the public policy initiative that we on the left wanted. And lastly, to this day, it is still the case that when the right tells you that a majority of people in this country oppose Obamacare, no, tell them if you include the number of people who wanted single payer, the vast majority, in fact, favor Obamacare or something far more akin to single payer.
Amen. Steve, well said. Good rant. Thanks for listening to WCPT. Sometimes my listeners' rants are even better than mine. That's great. Coming up tomorrow is Friday, and that means, of course, it's been 9 years now we've been doing this. Brunch with Bernie. Get your questions ready, because America's Senator, Senator Bernie Sanders, will be here for an hour taking your calls on the important issues of the week. And anything goes Friday. You get to pick the topic, although I'll have a few suggestions. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. Get out there, get active. And support the Hunter School. Go to hunterschool.org. It's the end of the year. It's a tax-deductible donation. Please help them out. Hunterschool.org. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.